You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I'm Aryeh Nair. I'm president of the Open Society Institute, and I'm very pleased to welcome you here this evening. The occasion for this event is the publication of Priscilla Hayner's book, Unspeakable Truths. Priscilla, who I think most of you know, or perhaps all of you know, is really the leading expert on truth commissions, published a book on this subject nearly a decade ago, and that has been the major reference work, among other things, for those who are concerned with truth commissions. This is an updated version of that book. A great deal has happened in this field over the period of time since the publication of the earlier version. So in essence, this is a new book. Priscilla, in addition to her role in as an expert on truth commissions, was one of the founding staff members of the International Center for Transitional Justice, and she has written and consulted widely on human rights issues. We also have the president of the International Center for Transitional Justice. I think he's about 6 months into his position as president of ICTJ. David Tolbert has a long record of participation in international efforts to provide accountability for gross human rights abuses. He was the deputy chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, and has also held leading UN posts concerned with the extraordinary chambers in Cambodia and with the tribunal that is now underway in Lebanon. Just by way of introduction, I wanted to say that the question of accountability for gross abuses of human rights has been at the top of the agenda for the international human rights movement for about the past quarter of a century. An immense amount has taken place during that quarter century. Priscilla Hayner discusses some 40 truth commissions in various countries during that period. Another aspect of the concern for accountability has been prosecutions of government officials and leaders of guerrilla movements for their role in gross abuses of human rights. A book published last year by Ellen Lutz and Caitlin Rieger listed some 67 prosecutions of heads of government or heads of state since 1990, either for human rights abuses or for corruption. I see a couple of colleagues here who have been associated with the effort to establish museums in different countries that commemorate the gross human rights abuses that have taken place in those countries. And that is also, I think, part of the struggle that has taken place worldwide for accountability for abuses. Truth commissions have had a very significant part in this struggle for accountability. I'm not going to go into the reasons for the role that truth commissions have played. I will leave that to Priscilla Haina. But after Priscilla and David have a chance to speak, I indicated that I would reserve the opportunity to add a few comments myself. But Priscilla is the author of the book that whose publication we are marking, and Priscilla will lead off.
Thank you very much, Arye, and thank you to OSI for hosting this event. It's so nice to see so many people here and so many friends, so many friends across the board. All of you are important. As Arye said, this is a book of 40 truth commissions, and I think it's fair to start with a question as to what does a book about 40 truth commissions tell us that a book about 20 truth commissions didn't tell us 10 years ago? Or to state it another way, a few smart people who I've run into in the last week have asked me, has my argument changed? And it's unfortunately sort of stopped me short, because the short answer is my argument hasn't changed, or my main conclusions haven't changed, because I think what we could see 10 years ago based on the 20 or so truth commissions at that point was fairly clear as to what the challenges were, as well as what some of the pretty remarkable contributions have been with different truth commissions. But having said that, I think any discussion today about truth commissions would be cut short or missing quite a bit if it didn't include some of the major cases that have taken place in the last 10 years. If you look at the truth commissions in Peru, in East Timor, or, for example, in Morocco, those three are three of the five of what I call the strongest truth commissions to date, joining South Africa and Guatemala. Extraordinarily rich experiences, each of them troubled in their own way, none of them reaching all of the successes or ends that people hope for them, but each of them quite remarkable endeavors. In their own respect. In addition, there's other less known truth commissions, such as the commission that's still underway in South Korea, which is looking in part, it's looking at 100 years, and much of its work is actually focused on the Korean War, including the role and the effect of U.S. troops in South Korea and in that civil war, and some of the unfortunate events that resulted in considerable civilian casualties. And they're digging up these kinds of facts decades after in a very different kind of environment that we've seen in any other Truth Commission investigation. Or the experiences of the Sierra Leonean or the Liberian Truth Commissions, which were difficult and challenged, but very important experiences to look at and learn from. Or one commission that's very little known, but that of Paraguay, which just concluded a couple of years ago, but was actually one of the strongest truth commissions to date in some ways in terms of its direct impact and trying to succeed in some very specific areas that it set out for itself. The depth and the breadth, I think, of these truth inquiries that we're seeing in different countries has given us a whole new level of understanding, and also a whole new level of being able to look at patterns of what's happening out there. What has been the impact of these kinds of bodies? It's also opened up new areas that these kinds of bodies are trying to operate in or have an impact on. And I would point to two or three. One is that there's an interesting new trend taking place now that truth commissions are being set up very explicitly with a prevention intention. Not just a generic nunca mas, let's not repeat a dictatorship in the future, such has been part of truth commissions from South Africa to Argentina and many others, but a very specific sense that if we don't look into what's happened very recently in this violence, we will see more violence very soon in the future. And this is a measure to prevent that. The two cases that come to mind most specifically in that area are Thailand, which is surprisingly now setting up a truth commission, a truth and reconciliation commission. It was announced a couple of months ago, so it's actually not in the book, so the book's actually already out of date, I have to say. But in Thailand, there were fewer than 100 people killed in protests that took place earlier this year. The response to that was not just to set up a commission of inquiry into the facts of the response to these public protests by the military, but actually to set up a truth commission, which left me very puzzled, I have to say, and very skeptical. But I actually traveled to Thailand, and I became persuaded that, in fact, it made sense in this context because they so saw this inquiry as looking beyond the specific facts of what took place earlier this year to look at root causes, look at the last several years where both sides of the political divide were back and forth with protests and some degrees of violence, and also to find a way to root this at the community level. So it's a very interesting and a very different kind of exercise. Similarly, although this is a troubled commission already, but in Kenya, when they set up the Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission last year, and also as they were being engaged by the International Criminal Court, both of those efforts were strongly supported by the public as well as by rights advocates, because people, including in the popular image, understood that accountability had to be part of prevention, that everyone is fearing considerable violence in the 2012 elections in Kenya, and if they don't name, identify, and hold people to account, then that violence will return. So it's a very interesting direct link that is much more explicit, I think, in some of these cases than we've seen elsewhere, where we've thought generally it would improve human rights. But this is actually a very specific intent. A second general trend is that truth commissions in some places are being set up to look at sort of deep and long-term historical issues, such as in Mauritius, where there's a truth commission currently underway that's looking at colonialism, slavery, and indentured servants from many hundreds of years back and the impact that that has had still today in community relations, in land issues, and in other challenges that they're still struggling with. And they intend to actually basing their work on the research coming out of the Truth Commission, actually grant reparations from things that happened generations ago. The chair of the Truth Commission in Mauritius was the deputy chair of the Truth Commission in South Africa, Alex Berain, who is probably well known to many people here. At the same time, Canada also has a Truth Commission underway at current time, and that commission is looking at the relationship with the indigenous community and the residential school system, which forcibly brought people into a mainstreaming system, which was also quite an abusive system. This is something that's looking at over 100 years of work and looking at sort of historical relationships, how that can be changed, and how that can affect what's happening today. And then finally, as I hinted in the case of Kenya, we're starting to see in real life form questions that will emerge about the relationship between the International Criminal Court and national truth commissions. There's all kinds of questions that will be raised there pertaining to sharing of information. Is it required that a national truth commission share information with ICC? Would there be access in the other way in terms of anybody that might be detained by the ICC? Which are questions that have been raised, for example, in the Sierra Leone case around the special court. There's a whole number of interesting questions there that haven't actually been confronted in real life situation, which I think if the Kenyan Truth Commission really gets up off the ground, is having some troubles now, which I'll return to, then we may see these things playing out. I think the book ultimately raises questions about the role and the impact, not just of truth commissions, but of transitional justice more generally. And I think the closer we look at some of these cases and how they actually play out, I think the more soberly we have to ask questions about what the impact is, and also recognize the difficulties of what that impact sometimes is and sometimes isn't. However, I think it's also fair to ask if the proliferation of truth commissions, now we're seeing new truth commissions come up relatively frequently, is that not just a sign of sort of the fashion of the day? And in some ways it is. If people see truth commissions in a positive light and they would like one for their country. And I think that's understandable, that fashionableness of truth commissions. I think from afar, the general impression of truth commissions is that they serve and satisfy the interests of victims, that they provide some sort of alternative accountability, which is less, you know, it's less tension producing than prosecutions. It advances reconciliation. It's somehow around restorative and not retributive justice, as we often heard in the South African case. Somehow it puts the past to bed without somehow endangering the future. Those are the kinds of things that one often hears in relationship to truth commissions. And perhaps it explains also why often truth commissions are incorporated fairly easily into peace agreements without too much discussion and without too much real appreciation for what it might mean, whether it's actually needed or appropriate for that country, but also without a lot of resistance, even by the perpetrators who would be investigated. Unfortunately, I think all of these assumptions, which I've just simplified and stated, need interrogating. Not to say that they're entirely wrong, but I think we need to be quite careful about what we assume. For example, certainly not all victims come out feeling good after speaking to a truth commission. Some of them feel quite re-traumatized. Certainly not all recommendations from commissions are implemented. So the long-term impact of change that's intended doesn't always take place. Some recommendations are implemented, but many have not been. And in fact, truth commissions usually end up urging prosecutions that they may start thinking that they're focused more on reconciliation in a non-prosecutorial way, which is true, but they hear so often from victims and survivors that prosecutions and criminal justice is essential for the victims, for the survivor communities, that the commissions themselves become strong advocates for the necessity for criminal justice where there's clear evidence against wrongdoers. One thing that's was interesting to me as I was working on the book was speaking with a number of people who I had spoken to 10 years ago from the human rights community about how they perceive truth commissions now versus how they perceived them 10 years ago. And I think one of the main changes is that 10 years ago there was a clear sense that there was this tension of truth versus justice, that if you had a truth commission, there was an implication that it was at the expense of having justice in the courts. And that made people quite nervous, that truth commissions were popping up in places and somehow weakening the prospect for justice. That concern has largely gone away, certainly amongst the human rights advocates that I've spoken with. I think now people appreciate the truth commissions, first of all, don't get in the way of criminal prosecutions. Very few, almost except for South Africa, none others have had an amnesty component, for example. That's quite unique to South Africa, amnesty for any of the more serious crimes such as that commission had. But also commissions usually end up providing information either to the prosecutor, to the government directly, confidentially, or to the courts, whatever the system may be at the national level, and urging and sometimes following cases and pushing that there be prosecution. So, in fact, now people see that there could be quite a positive link between having a truth commission sometimes first when you can't have prosecutions. It's a way to preserve evidence. It's a way to organize the bigger picture of patterns of what took place, et cetera. However, I'd like to clarify that having stated my skepticism about the impact, I'm not trying to argue that there's no impact of truth commissions. just that I think the expectations have been both perhaps too simplistic and far too high as to what countries are hoping and assuming that they will get by setting up a truth commission. The impact that I have seen has been in a few particularly interesting ways. I've been struck, and I know there's some experts in the room here on the topic of reparations, but I've been struck that in a number of cases there's a very clear link, in fact, between Truth Commission recommendations and a reparations policy being formed, sometimes quite significant programs. There's a number of cases where there's recommendations that fall flat. I'm not saying that all of them are implemented, and there's been a lot of frustration around this. But there's actually a number of very interesting cases, such as in Chile or Morocco, where there was a direct relationship between the work of a truth commission and direct and significant reparations that followed. There have also been some significant reforms in a number of countries as a result of commission recommendations, particularly in the area of judicial reform at the Supreme Court level and other structural and legal structural levels, which is important, I think, because it's an area that can be handled with such difficulty by other institutions. In other words, the courts themselves, of course, are not going to do a self-review, and usually the independence of the courts makes it difficult for other kinds of massive reform. But with this kind of review, and especially when the judiciary has been corrupted itself in the systems of violence, it's sometimes possible to use this sort of wealth and depth of information about what took place and the complicity of the judiciary in some cases to actually have some significant reforms. Having said that not all victims come out feeling better from truth commissions, and I think we need to keep that in mind, there are, on the other hand, some important cases. I think in any country where there's statement taking of thousands of victims, public hearings, etc., it's going to be a mixed picture as to what that impact is at the individual level. But some victims come out feeling like this really helped them to move on and to heal, and the passion they have for that need for acknowledgement of what took place is very important. And then finally, just the extraordinary amount of detailed, rich information that has emerged in these commission reports, as well as in the public hearings that they often hold, are just sometimes extraordinary. I would then just ask, what makes some truth commissions more successful than others? I mean, what are the factors that would determine that? And it's not too much of a surprise, probably, if I say political will. Is there really an intention to have change take place? Capacity, because there may be good intentions, but it's just really hard to do. And many truth commissions try, but just can't quite put together such a difficult and cumbersome and politically risky project. And then finally, membership. This is where the Kenyan Truth Commission has run into trouble. The chair of the Kenyan Commission is somebody who was very closely associated with the former regime of President Moi and held very senior positions under Moi during some critical times, actually at some of the worst violence of Kenya. And he has not been accepted in Kenya by victims groups, by human rights groups, and he refuses to resign. So they're stuck. So they're essentially losing lots of time being stuck. If you get the wrong members, then it's a problem. You can work with a weak mandate and many other things, but it's really the people that count the most. The other bad example in that area is in Congo, in DRC, where there was a truth commission set up, came out of the peace agreement of 8 years ago. But it really never got going, in part because some of the members themselves, in fact, were known to be human rights violators. They were appointed by the rebel groups, and some of them had actually been named in international human rights reports as human rights violators. So there was no chance that they were going to build trust in the population. So finally, I think I would conclude by saying that it's easy to oversell or overrate truth commissions, although I think the tendency is getting better, certainly amongst the international community working in this area. I think people are quite appreciative of being sober in their assessments. But I think it's also too easy to throw truth commissions out and dismiss them as oversold. I think, in fact, somewhere in the middle is a wiser path, that, yes, they're not sufficient, but if done really well, they can make a very important step in the right direction and should be sort of supported in that spirit. So I think I'm hoping that the book and its descriptions of the actual challenges faced by these bodies and how this all adds up will help us to assess transitional justice more soberly as well. How does this all fit together, and how is it that one can actually address the past and move forward? Thank you very much, Arye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, David Talbot.
Thank you very much. It's always difficult to follow the author of the book, so particularly when she makes some of the same points I was going to make. But I really want to thank OSI for this opportunity for the launching of what I think is a very important book. As has been already noted, Priscilla is a co-founder of ICTJ and really a pillar in the field of transitional justice, and not just in truth commissions, but in the whole field of transitional justice. So it's a pleasure to be on the same panel with her, and I would really like to congratulate her on what I think is a terrific book. I think what she's been able to do in this book is, and it's actually a lot shorter than it looks, because she's got these great tables and lists, and she's got an index and so forth, and appendixes. It's really only sort of about this long, and it can be read relatively quickly, because I only got the copy on Wednesday. And it is a new book, too, because, as Priscilla's pointed out, the last decade has seen an explosion of truth commissions. So what she's been able to do is capture an enormous amount of information about truth commissions in a relatively short space, really outline some of the very issues that she's talked about here. And what I think is really interesting about the book, and I'll come back to this in a moment, is that much of it, of course, is quite practical and addressed at the issues that confront a truth commission and being set up and developing a database and developing a methodology and so forth. But interspersed in those chapters, I think, are some very interesting chapters that relate to deeper questions, some which I think are philosophical, some which go to the heart of what transitional justice is and what truth commissions do. So I'm making a play for you to go out and buy a few of these books as you leave, because I think it in a very direct way gives you a great overview and deep knowledge at the same time on truth commissions, but also on transitional justice. What I'd like to do is focus on one or two general comments and then a couple of specific ones. At the outset, I think, as a general comment, I think that the book really makes the point of the difficulties in setting these commissions up and the difficult bursts that so many of the, in fact, almost all of the commissions have. They have political challenges, they have limited powers, they're frequently the result of awkward compromises. Priscilla's already talked about that to some extent. They have limited mandates, sometimes extremely limited resources. And I would include that in what Priscilla calls the five strongest commissions as well, which were South Africa, Guatemala, Peru, Timor-Leste, and Morocco. They all faced enormous challenges as well. And despite these enormous challenges, they've not uniformly, but many of them have had a tremendous impact on the societies through what I would call the power of truth. And that's where I think some of the chapters in which Priscilla discusses what is truth and what is truth to the victims. It's so critically important in the stories that come out. Now, what I'd also like to talk a little bit about is to mention is that I think what's important here is that there's a comparative experience vis-a-vis all of these truth commissions, and it's through the sifting and the looking at the 40 overall truth commissions where you can draw what I think are some very important lessons on the establishment of truth commissions and going forward with them. So in that sense, I think that the book also underlines something that's very important about transitional justice generally, and that is the comparative expertise, and I'm not just making a plug for ICTJ here, but the comparative comparisons between truth commissions, but also other mechanisms of transitional justice across the board between different situations, because one of the things that I think comes out in this book, as Priscilla goes through the various comparisons of truth commissions and you line them up one by one, and it's really very interesting and useful, that is the charts. She has charts looking at the various transitional justice mechanisms and how each of these 40 commissions did on issues of prosecutions or criminal justice, also on reparations, and I'll come back to this theme in a moment, on institutional reform. You can see where some of them have been strong in terms of the mandates, and you can see where some of them have evolved, and you can see where some of them have failed. But what I'd like to turn to now and talk a little bit about is how truth commissions interact with other transitional justice mechanisms. And particularly, I want to focus on, obviously, prosecutions or criminal justice, and then talk a little bit about reparations, and then the security sector reform. And as Priscilla has already made the point that there has been, certainly in the past, a great deal of tensions from those who are in the international justice practitioners and those who have supported truth commissions. And I can remember back in the 90s when I was at the Yugoslavia Tribunal, there was a very strong reaction to the possibility of a truth commission in Bosnia. And I think you may have worked on this, Priscilla. I know Neil Kritz from USIP put this forward. And two people I respect and worked with very closely, Louise Arbour and Gabby McDonald, reacted very, very negatively, and it was a great deal of pushback, because it was seen at that point in time that truth commissions would undermine the work of criminal justice. And what I think's very what's a great step forward is that I don't think that view is held today by any of it's broadly not held, but by international justice practitioners. And Priscilla has a very good chapter on truth and justice with a question mark, but I think we can erase that question mark now, because the examples that she gives over and over of where truth commissions have facilitated justice processes, whether it's in Guatemala, Peru, Chile, et cetera, I think are persuasive. Now, part of this, I think, comes from the South Africa Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and which I agree with Priscilla's assessment that it's one of the five strongest, or perhaps the strongest, or one of the strongest truth commissions. On the other hand, it is still seen, I think, in the popular imagination as the truth commission. And the fact that it had provided for amnesty for truthful testimony relating to political crimes, and I think I'm correct, and Priscilla makes this point in the book over and over, it is the only such commission to provide for this amnesty. There was in the mind of many that truth and justice were either incompatible or not on friendly terms. And I think that is one of the central findings of the book, and one of the things that we've come to understand over the last 10 years, that they actually work together, and there's a great deal of overlap, and these commissions show how prosecutions and criminal justice can be facilitated by truth commissions. And frankly, in many cases, not in all cases, and I'll come back to this in a moment, but in many cases, it's possible to have a truth commission which makes recommendations with respect to prosecutions that when prosecutions are simply not possible in that particular environment, and they'll be possible later. So I think that's one of the important findings of the book, and I think it confirms something that I've come to understand, and I suspect if we went back to 1995 or 1996 in the Yugoslavia tribunal context, we would have a very different position than we do today. Priscilla has touched on the question of reparations already, and I think it's what's important here is to underline again that in terms of transitional justice, the truth commissions are making important findings with respect to reparations, both in terms of recommending reparations programs, which are now have overtaken the kind of traditional idea of reparations that are paid for by or recovered from perpetrators, but reparation programs which address a wide variety of injuries and suffering that victims have experienced. Now, I think the question of the victim's experience vis-a-vis the Truth Commission, I agree with Priscilla, is a more complicated set of issues, and we have experts in psychology and these fields here tonight, and I'm sure they have views on that. But with respect to reparations and reparative justice in the formal sense, truth commissions have made an enormous amount of impact over and over, and their recommendations, and this is well illustrated in the book, I think really truly advanced the cause of reparations and reparative justice. The Moroccan Commission, I think, is a very good example, too, of where, in addition to the reparations issue, we can see social and economic and cultural rights deeply affected, because in the Moroccan context, whereas under local law, a daughter or a female could only claim half of that of a male, that was not followed, and women received the full benefit and actually made claims in their own name, which was contrary to local law. So we can see in this aspect of truth commissions actually breaking down and breaking down barriers in relation to gender, and also advancing economic and social and cultural rights. The Canadian Truth Commission is an excellent example of cultural rights actually being implemented as we speak. And we had a very interesting experience the other day at the ICTJ when we had the Canadian Truth Commissioners there, and we had experts from Latin American commissions, from Peru, from Guatemala, and so forth. And actually, it was very much a South-North relationship where those from Latin America were advising the Canadian Truth Commissioners on how to address these social, economic, and cultural rights issues that are being addressed in Canada right now. So in this sense, I think that there's a lot of groundbreaking effort that goes on. On the other, in terms of institutional reforms, I think we see much less of that. There are problems, as you noted earlier, Priscilla, with respect to some of the recommendations. There are some examples, I think, in Chile and elsewhere where there have been recommendations related to a security sector reform. But frankly, and this is where these charts at the end are very useful, because when I was checking myself last night in preparation, I went through, and in terms of vetting, there were only two or three examples, whereas if you turn to prosecutions over the 40 commissions, there were many examples of where they facilitated prosecutions. And there were a good many examples, less so with respect to reparations, and just simply a handful with respect to institutional reforms. So I think on all of those fronts, the book brings a wealth of information and makes us all much wiser in terms of where truth commissions stand today, the very difficult issues that are faced in establishing truth commissions, and some of the problems that actually result from truth commissions, because it's not a linear line. But I'd also like to just take I'm probably close to being out of time, but two comments on what I would refer to as the other chapters, because Priscilla and I have both in our remarks very much focused, I think, on the technical aspects and how these commissions work and their impact in a kind of linear sense. But I think there are some very interesting chapters, and I jotted some of the names of these chapters as What is Truth, Truth and Justice, Healing from the Past, Reconciliation, Learning from the Past, which I think raise some really interesting points for discussion and issues. And I'll just touch on two of them. One in the chapter called What is Truth? I think there's some really interesting questions there that are raised. And as I think is obvious, I come very much from the criminal justice point of view or the criminal justice background. And of course, the way a lot of truth commissions have functioned is to some extent similar to how a prosecutor would investigate a crime in terms of taking witness statements and developing the evidence and then recording that evidence and putting it in databases and then creating a record from that. But in the book, Priscilla touches on, I think, in particular, I think it was in Guatemala, the Historical Clarification Commission, and really something even more interesting, I thought, which was the precursor to that commission, which was the Recovery of Historical Memory Project, which was undertaken by the Human Rights Office of the Archbishop of Guatemala. And their approaches, I think, went far beyond documenting the human rights abuses and sort of the classical sense of documenting human rights abuses, and tried to look at the underlying causes and origins of the conflict. And I think that is it's something that truth commissions can get at in a way that criminal trials and perhaps other transitional justice mechanisms have a hard time getting at. And they can provide a very rich, perhaps more discursive way of looking at the conflict and some of the economic causes and giving a broader picture, which at the end of the day is a form of historical memory and in a way creating I think the possibility for a much greater understanding of what happened in that conflict than other mechanisms and other approaches, and perhaps only historians could produce. And finally, and I think this is an interesting point, this is maybe a little bit of a difference. We should have some minor disagreement, Priscilla, in closing. And there was a chapter that struck me called leaving the past alone. And there were two examples that were given. One was Mozambique, and one was Cambodia. Now, I'm not an expert on Mozambique, but as has been referenced, I've had a bit of experience in Cambodia. And while I think it's true, there has been no truth commission in Cambodia, and the ECCC, the Extraordinary Chambers and the Courts of Cambodia, have just rendered their first verdict. But I do think that case, and then sometimes perhaps prosecutions or criminal justice ends up going first. And I think in that case, the Doit case has shown in a very deep and real way that despite the lapse of a very long period of time, there was a great hungering for confronting and understanding the past. And before the court got started, and particularly before this judgment and some very good outreach work that was done, and I'll be the first to say the enormous flaws in the court in many respects, but the impact of the case and the fact that now before it wasn't taught in the schools. The Khmer Rouge period was not taught in the schools. And previously it wasn't talked about in families and wasn't talked about in society. And today it is in a very deep way talked about. And I think this is something that comes up over and over, even where the conflict seems to be frozen. At the end of the day, even in a place like Spain, where the atrocities of the 30s were covered up with amnesty and a lot of other efforts, today people are going and trying to find their great-grandfathers and great-grandmothers who were killed in this conflict and recover their remains, that there is a deep yearning in all of these societies, and I suspect even in Mozambique at the end of the day, over time, where the past must be confronted with. So I know it's not much of a disagreement, but I had to look for something, Priscilla. And so that's my example, and I want to congratulate you on an outstanding book, and many thanks for all of us who are working on transitional justice for producing such an excellent piece of work. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to comment on one point that has been discussed already and then raise one issue that has not been talked about. The point that has been discussed already is what was perceived for a period, and I think rightly it is suggested that it is no longer perceived in that way, as a conflict between telling the truth and doing justice. I think that perception of a conflict had some specific historical circumstances that inspired it. I think the country that probably played the most significant role in making it seem that there was a conflict was Chile. In the case of Chile, the transition took place in 1990. Pinochet had lost a plebiscite in 1988, and then there was a contested election in 1990, and the government the democratic government that was established in Chile in 1990 did not try to challenge the amnesty law that Pinochet himself had decreed. It established a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That was the name that was given to it in Chile, and South Africa took the name from the Chilean example. And the authors of the Chilean Truth and Reconciliation Commission were looking at what had happened next door in Argentina, where there had been a Truth Commission, and the name Truth Commission derives from Argentina, where the mothers of the disappeared wanted the truth about what had happened to their children. And the Truth Commission had seemed to them quite successful. On the other hand, in Argentina, there had also been prosecutions, and then there had been rebellions by middle-level officers when prosecutions began focusing on them. And the Argentine government survived those rebellions. But then Argentina pardoned those who had been convicted previously in the justice process in Argentina. And the Chilean view was, truth is possible, justice is too difficult. It's especially difficult because the military continues to have its guns. Under the Chilean constitution, Pinochet was no longer president, but he remained commander of the army. He made explicit threats against anyone who would try to prosecute any of his men. And so rather than risk justice, Chile established a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And so there were those within the human rights community who were very unhappy about what had taken place in Chile at that time. And I think that was where the idea of a conflict between truth and justice originated. When it came up in the case of Bosnia, there was another problem, and that is that in the early days of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, the partisans of the court were always worried that the court would be dissolved. They were worried about that at the time of the Dayton peace talks. Richard Holbrooke was not happy that General Mladic and Radovan Karadzic had been indicted by the tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. That meant they couldn't go to Dayton because they couldn't risk arrest, and he worried that that would undermine the peace negotiations. In fact, it turned out that it facilitated the peace negotiations. Milosevic had not yet been indicted, and Milosevic negotiated a peace agreement that Karadzic and Mladic might not have gone along with if they had been able to take part. But the tribunal was very much at risk at that moment, and it continued at risk thereafter, in part because it seemed to lack credibility. It didn't have any defendants. It had Dusko Tadic, but that was about it in the early period. And then Tony Blair was elected in 1997, and he appointed Robin Cook as his foreign secretary. And Robin Cook was a great partisan of the tribunal and basically changed British policy so that the British troops in Bosnia began making arrests of people who had been indicted by the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And those arrests began to create credibility for the tribunal, and also inspired American forces to make arrests in Bosnia. Previously, NATO troops had essentially allowed people who had been indicted to pass through checkpoints and had not bothered them. But in the period when the tribunal seemed to lack credibility and seemed at risk of being abolished, the idea of a truth commission looked like an easy way of letting off the war criminals who had committed the terrible crimes that had taken place in Bosnia. And so once again, it seemed there was a conflict between providing the truth and doing justice, and especially with respect to the kinds of crimes that had taken place in Bosnia, it seemed very important to do justice. As I say, those were specific historical circumstances, and I think they created the sense of competition or the sense of rivalry between the truth approach and doing justice. I think what we have learned since, as Priscilla has demonstrated, is that the two can be complementary to each other. A justice process can go after only a very limited number of persons and hold them accountable. I think if you take the total number of persons who have been prosecuted by all the international tribunals, it is something in the neighborhood of 250. That's significant, but an awful lot more persons than that were culpable for the vast number of human rights abuses that have taken place worldwide. And the truth process can document the involvement of large numbers of persons in committing very serious abuses of human rights. It can deal with the sufferings of very large numbers of persons. It can present a fuller historical picture of what took place, and so it can be complementary to what takes place in a justice process rather than be seen as a competitor. The other point that I wanted to make, and a fairly obvious point, is that there was at least some effort in the United States when the Obama administration came into to office to see the establishment of a truth commission in the United States to deal with abuses that took place in the Bush administration. Priscilla touches on this briefly, but doesn't go into this at length, but I think it is worth at least thinking about why that went nowhere in the United States. There was no significant support for that kind of commission. And the point was driven home for me listening to you mention the Canadian commission concerned with the abuses against the indigenous population in Canada. Because, of course, the very same abuses took place in the United States. There were boarding schools operated by the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Oklahoma and Utah. And their explicit mission was to de-Indianize Indians. And they had disastrous effects. Large numbers of Indian or indigenous children from Alaska, among other things, were sent to the boarding schools in Oklahoma and Utah, and they learned not to be Indians, and that's about all that they learned. And if you went to Anchorage and you went to the Skid Row, you saw the consequences of those boarding schools. You saw large numbers of Indians staggering drunk on the streets, and they were the products of the boarding schools. They had learned to reject their villages, but they had not learned anything else in those Indian schools, and they had disastrous consequences. But it would be inconceivable that the United States would deal with a situation like that. And it turned out to be impossible to establish a commission to deal with the torture, the renditions, prolonged detention without charges or trial that were practiced by the Bush administration. And you know, the question one has to ask oneself is, why are we not able to address these kinds of issues in the United States? There's an element of American exceptionalism here. That is, if it's good enough for anybody else, it's not good enough for us, or it's not appropriate for our purposes. From the Obama administration's standpoint, they had a political agenda. They had an economy in trouble, a health care bill to pass. They didn't want to get sidetracked into political struggles over the question of accountability. And there wasn't enough public support to make the call for the establishment of a commission in the United States a credible cause. I don't know what the answer is to that question, but I think it's worth thinking about as we consider the way in which a very large number of other countries have managed to confront their own past and really come to grips with their own past by establishing commissions that look back at troubled periods of their history, and in fact very large periods of their history, and really provide a significant way for the society to try to heal some of the wounds that it caused to itself by its past practices. At any rate, that's my comment. So I don't know, Priscilla, if you want to respond at all to David or to me, or whether we should now open it up. So it's up to you.
Perhaps because of the limited time, we could open it up, and I'll respond in the course.
Okay, let's open it up. If you'd go to a microphone, please.
My name is Benny Vidiono. My expertise, if any, is Cambodia. So you have, Priscilla, already talked about the explosion in truth commissions, but I'm asking you about one that is missing, and that is a truth commission on Cambodia. Of course, as David says, on chapter 14, you mentioned the 30 years of delay in this truth commission, in this trial. I just recently wrote an op-ed piece in the New Mandala entitled An Alternative View of the Deutsch Trial. And here I will disagree with David. We worked together maybe on the other side during the Cambodia, the making of the ECCC. Now, David mentioned that the trial is 30 years late, but it still brings up a new awareness of the Khmer Rouge. And I agree with him, but why should we have to use a bazooka to kill a fly, you see? The Cambodian people now are all under 30, well, not all, but 70% maybe. And they need to know about the Khmer Rouge. And I agree with you that this book published by DC Cam on the Khmer Rouge is a very good way to teach the young people about the Khmer Rouge atrocity. And it's much cheaper and it's much less complex. Now, about the Truth Commission, why it was not done in Cambodia, I personally feel that, you know, the 30 years absence of the Khmer Rouge trial, as you, I'm sure, know, is because of manipulations in the General Assembly, where the United States and China together managed to recognize the Khmer Rouge for 11 more years as the government of Cambodia after they were defeated by Vietnam. This is because Vietnam was obviously on the other side of the war. So, in a truth commission, would something like that come out? Or that the Khmer Rouge itself was actually a small movement under Pol Pot and became very big because of Nixon's bombings and of the overthrow of Sihanouk by a pro-American general, which brought Sihanouk to Beijing and made the Khmer Rouge what it was. So my question is, would a truth commission bring more guilty parties? Because in a criminal justice ECCC, we have 5 Khmer Rouge generals. You know, nothing is said about Nixon bombings or about the General Assembly recognizing the Khmer Rouge for 11 years. With a truth commission, and just to show that I'm not partial, although I'm Indonesian, with the truth commission of East Timor, Timor-Leste, also name the Indonesian generals who were massacring the Timor-Leste people. Thank you.
Okay. Do you want to respond?
Maybe we should take a couple of questions. questions.
Well, let's take a couple additional questions and then we'll respond. Okay. Bill Pace.
Just a couple of quick points. Bill Pace, I guess, here on the Coalition for the International Criminal Court. One is that I do think the way those groups and sectors working on international justice and truth and peace commissions, who there was a concerted effort to pit us against each other and it failed, is an important success story. Unfortunately, I don't think it's over. I think, as we see in U.S. politics, the opponents regroup, come back, and the next time they almost are even more dangerous in how they will go after this. But I do think it is important that the two initiatives keep in mind that they are complementary and they are not, and it is, and unfortunately, one of the main groups besides the Pinochets and others that will try to pit us against each other are peace negotiators, professional peace negotiators, and that group who, and the so-called real politic group who think that any of this is ridiculous and doesn't help move things forward. A second point I wanted to make is Aria raised it, and I've talked about it quietly over the years, but I think it ought to be noted. Robin Cook made an extraordinary contribution that people don't realize on the ICC and the Rome Statute. He was much more important than anyone has ever given him credit for. And it just shows it's an example of how an individual foreign minister can make a substantial difference at the global level, and he did it fairly quietly, and et cetera. But he turned policy around, and he stood firm. And I remember when this all was being at risk in that week of 2002, between in June to mid-July, when the Bush administration came in and started vetoing the renewal of peacekeeping operations until they got an ICC resolution out of the Security Council. And Robin Cook called me like three times a day, because he was, believe it or not getting an accurate report on what his country's position was from his ambassador here at the UN. I just wanted to say that this was a really good example of a story that someday I hope will get written in a larger way.
Just a couple real quick questions. Many people refer to truth commissions as TRCs. What role do you think reconciliation should play in truth commissions? And do you have a general sense of a report card on how these 40 have done on gender issues?
Why don't we take the responses now, okay? Priscilla?
I'll answer those three and then maybe quick comments as well on the comments that you all have made. In terms of the question about if there were a truth commission in Cambodia, would it get to these other issues? And I think the example you gave is a very good example of the kind of thing a truth commission typically would not only look into, investigate, but also report on. And it's exactly as you said, it's not the kind of thing that's usually appropriate to come out in trials or to be investigated in the course of trial. Contextual, historical facts, sometimes uncomfortable facts, that have not been fully recognized. Now, there have been truth commissions in the past, especially some of the earlier ones in Central America, which were criticized for not actually dealing well and hardly actually addressing the role of the U.S. in the wars and in funding the governments that massively backed the wars in Central America. They addressed it only briefly, and they mostly skirted that issue. But I think today that would be very unlikely. There's been a considerable strengthening in a recognition by truth commissions in today's era that they really need to look at these contextual factors. So as you said, the role of the U.S., where the war or where the Khmer Rouge came from, and the continued support would be documented, I'm sure. In terms of other commissions such as in East Timor, whether they name names, Each commission is different, if my recollection is correct, and I'm sure there are people here who know exactly, and things get fuzzy when I try to remember 40 commissions, but I have to admit, but I believe the East Timor Commission named some of the most senior persons, and they put those names in the report, and then there were lower level people that they didn't put in the report, which is one common path now, or they would put some names in a confidential annex, perhaps to the government if there's security concerns. But I think in that case they actually did name and suggested that there be an international tribunal considered to handle that, which was not followed up on. I disagree slightly with Bill Pace in terms of the ogre-ness of the mediation community. There are some mediators, certainly, who think that human rights are a complicating factor, period. But there's actually many that don't think that. And there's a considerable acceptance now in the mediation community that there's a red line on amnesties that's not really questioned now. People understand it makes their job difficult, but they understand it's there. Even if it's not an ICC member state, it's sort of the new standard that you can't provide amnesty for serious international crimes. Again, that's not universal, but most people accept that as being a truth today, by far the vast majority. And I think most mediators understand human rights broadly and specifically dealing with the past issues as something that can be a positive element, can be handled. There's creative ways of handling it. There needs to be, I think, more communication between these two worlds, but we're getting there.
Priscilla, if I can interject, one could point to Kofi Annan's role with Kenya in terms of his insistence on the human rights components of the peace agreement that was reached there.
Yeah. The Kenyans started off assuming they would have a Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission, and that's as much thought as they'd given in terms of human rights components. And we were able to essentially move the parties to accepting also a more criminal justice-focused commission of inquiry, which was quite hard-hitting, which ended up resulting in the ICC engagement in the country as well, and a truth commission, which was, you know, the language was relatively strong. As I said, they've run into all kinds of problems since, but they were open to this. Both parties, I was involved in this at the time, and both parties felt correctly that they were victims because the other party had done something to wrong them. And there's a little bit of a, you know, obviously it goes both directions. So they supported the idea of accountability as well as the mediation team there. I mean, perhaps as a footnote, it struck me as I was writing the book that the truth versus justice tension has largely gone away, and I think it's been replaced now with peace versus justice, and people trying to sort of get their head around how do you do peace and justice at the same time. I mean, it's a different question, obviously, but it's something that I think we're all still working through. In terms of Kelly's questions about reconciliation, I, as you might have noticed, don't call these TRCs, because there's been quite a few truth commissions that actually didn't set as their mandate to advance reconciliation. They really prioritized fact-finding. They were looking at information, evidence, patterns. They weren't trying to necessarily have a direct impact on reconciliation. And there's some context, such as in Argentina, where people at the time, and I think still today, are offended at the suggestion that truth would lead to reconciliation. I mean, just knowing who killed your daughter, why would that make me reconcile with the perpetrator, you know, is what people would say. And reconciliation took on a very negative connotation because it had been used by the government to justify basically amnesty laws, quasi-amnesty laws. So the human rights community did not hang on to that terminology. So I think I try to be careful not to generalize that as a presumption, although many truth commissions today have taken on reconciliation as a aim. Now, Kelly's question really was, you know, is that an appropriate aim? And I think it is, with care, because the problem is it sometimes trips up commissions I know in Peru there were months and months spent on a debate between the commissioners as to whether they were really about truth-finding or whether they were really about reconciliation. In South Africa, some decisions by the Amnesty Committee were based, in fact, as I was told by Amnesty Committee members, that whether they thought it would promote reconciliation, that would help to balance whether someone would be granted amnesty, which is, you know, it's pretty close to the edge as to what should be appropriate and how one is actually defining that. In terms of the question on gender, I would give commissions maybe a C+, B- in that area. They're trying. They know that they aren't doing well. There's the language, there's the special staff, special commissioners, usually a gender balance in the commissioners is required. There's been efforts, but many commissions have ended up concluding themselves that they sort of missed somehow part of the story. Because the way that women are affected by repression or by war is different, not all women and all men, but there's a general tendency of a different kind of experience which might actually not be captured if one is counting victims of torture and victims of disappearance, but not actually looking at, well, what happens to the people who survived when a family member was disappeared? What happened in terms of the economic structures? What is it that caused and allowed this to take place? Who is it that was actually holding the communities together and then maybe were punished for that once many people were disappeared? So there's this second and third level that is sometimes just not captured. So I think there needs to be, I mean, there is work going on in that area, and I think the more work, the better. Maybe just a couple quick questions on the very interesting comments from both of you. I was struck with your comment, Arye, about the U.S. and the flirtation, unfortunately brief, with the idea of having a truth commission here about the rendition and detention and torture policies. And I remember when it was first proposed to have a truth commission by a senator, actually Senator Leahy, shortly after Obama was inaugurated. And one of the first reactions to that, and I can't remember which senator it was, but his reaction was, we're not Latin America, you know, we don't need a truth commission. So that is exactly as you said. I mean, you know, why would we do something like that? And in fact, the advocacy around it was really referring to it more as a commission of inquiry, because I think it made more sense in this context, which is fine. And then perhaps a final comment. What's interesting, if you look now at, for example, the case of Chile that you cited, is, and there's several cases now where this is true, at the time people collected information, having no sense that there might be trials in the future, as a matter of fact, a sense that there wouldn't ever be trials. And so there were truth commissions that collected just incredible information. And then in the case of Chile, it was only about a dozen, 12, 14 years later that things really started shifting. And now there are hundreds of people in detention or on trial in Chile. Quite a number of people have been convicted, senior military officers. And one of the sources that they're turning to is the archive from the Truth Commission in Chile, and which is also true in Argentina. I mean, whether to the usefulness of that, whether that information is different from what they have from other sources, not always. But it's one of the sources that they always look at. And I think it says something about, you know, things change in time. Things open up and are possible that are not first seen to be possible. Thank you very much.
David, do you want to comment?
Yeah, just a couple of quick comments. Since I'm from North Carolina, I do have to point out there was a truth commission in Greensboro, North Carolina, over the Ku Klux Klan Communist Party shootout, which killed all the communists in North Carolina, I think. But that has nothing to do with the U.S. government. But there was that sort of exception. On the RA's points on the Yugoslavia Tribunal, are ones that I made repeatedly in 96 and 97. I think it's still a valid argument. I do think that, of course, one of the consequences was that the idea of a truth commission now is being vetted again on a regional basis with Natasha Kantic and Rick Kamm talking about it, but that's 13, 14 years after the fact. But I think that argument, but I agreed with that argument. I made it myself at the time, but I do think we have moved to a different place, and I do would join both of you, I think, in terms of, or Bill and as well, in terms of the role of Robin Cook, which was so tremendous for the Yugoslavia Tribunal. I think you can trace the date of the turn to the intervention of the arrest of those British troops in, I think, May of 1996, summer of 1997. And he is really an unsung hero. Those of you who don't know the story of Robin Cook, he unfortunately died some years back, but he had what was called a moral foreign policy, and I think we need a few more Robin Cooks. In terms of Cambodia, I don't. When you say a bazooka to kill a fly, I think that Khmer Rouge is a lot more than a fly. I think I would leave it at that. We just agree to disagree on that point.
By the fly, I mean the book to instruct the young people. You know, that's a fly in terms of cost. I'm an economist.
We can argue about it, but I do think that the Tribunal, despite all of its flaws and all of its costs, has had a tremendous impact, and it was possible, whereas the Truth Commission was not. On the truth versus justice argument that Bill talked about, I think one of the really important points Priscilla made, but I think I'd make it even stronger. I think with the adoption of the Rome Statute, amnesty is off the table for Rome Statute crimes, for crimes against humanity, for war crimes, for genocide. And in that sense, it clarifies the situation considerably on the what used to be called truth versus justice, but which is now truth and justice. And we've moved from, I think, where the real arena and the discussion is on peace versus justice to peace. It would be referred to in the past as peace versus justice, now peace and justice. And we had a very interesting discussion, I guess, Bill, you were there, in Kampala, where I, as a former prosecutor, one of Priscilla's colleagues from Humanitarian Dialogue, who was a negotiator, and we were, I think, more or less on the same page. I mean, he agreed. Amnesty was off the table. And it's simply, I there will no doubt, of course, be other assaults, Bill, in the future, and I think we should prepare ourselves. But I think that bottom line helps us for the future, and I'm optimistic in that debate. And I think I would also join Priscilla with some skepticism about the, mine might even be deeper in terms of the use of the term reconciliation. I think truth is the discourse and the object, and it may very well lead to reconciliation, but it's truth that we're after, and so I think that in terms of reconciliation, that may be a product, but the process is one of truth.
I was supposed to end this by 7 o'clock. It's now about 5 minutes after seven. What I suggest is that we have two people at the microphone, no statements, a brief question, and brief responses. Okay?
Okay, I'll do my best. I agree with what David said.
No agreement. Question.
Oh, well. It's a statement, I'm afraid.
Okay. Ren, only a question.
Just continuing with the... this is a question. To all of you, in a way, starting with Greensboro and also the idea, the thought experiment of a truth commission in the United States, it strikes me that our Fox News versus MSNBC policy is so divided at this point that I'm not sure, you know, just fact-finding that people are susceptible to fact or can agree on what facts are at this point. Is this worse, to Aria maybe to begin with, is this worse than it's ever been? And to about Greensboro, looking at Greensboro, I imagine it was probably very divided when it began. Is there now a consensus about what the facts are that somehow got around this? And then the other question would be, is the United States stranger in this way than Chile or than Argentina? I mean, is there a kind of an agreement about facts in those places that one can't imagine ever getting to in the United States at this point, or that set of questions?
I don't have an easy answer for you, but I would say this, that one of the ways in which the United States has dealt with some things of this sort in the past is through congressional inquiries. And if you think back to, let's say, the Church Committee and its inquiry into CIA abuses, the idea of a congressional inquiry was also completely squelched at this time. And so there was a kind of decision in Washington, with very few people disagreeing from it, Leahy being the main exception, that nothing should be done by way of an inquiry, not a congressional inquiry, not a special commission. There have been commissions in American history. We've had, you know, the Wickenden Commission, which looked into criminal justice abuses. It certainly feels weird now. Whether it's weirder than it's ever been, the country has been very seriously divided at other points in American history. If one goes back to the McCarthy period, even relatively recently, the Nixon period, if one goes back to the post-World War I period when there were very severe civil liberties abuses in the United States, the country was very seriously divided. Whether it's worse now than it's ever been, I'm not sure. At this moment, it certainly does feel very weird. But those were life and death kinds of situations in those countries. In Argentina, tens of thousands of people had lost immediate members of their family to the abuses that took place. At the same time, there were, people who were very supportive of the military, and there was the military itself. The country was extremely divided, and nevertheless, they managed to have a successful truth commission.
I remember in Chile, this was 5 years after, I guess, the truth commission report, so 96 or so when I traveled there. And I remember speaking with a survivor of torture and asking her, trying to get at some of these sort of, how does this play out today in Chile? And she said, it's bad taste to bring up these topics in any social context. You can't actually say anything about torture, even though you're a torture survivor yourself or you had a disappeared family member. It's considered socially bad taste, bad manners. And it was a striking description of how there hadn't actually been what we might call reconciliation, sort of people kind of agreeing on what had taken place, even though there had been a truth commission, very powerful, but it was still somehow polarized. And many, many countries, as obviously you know well, have very polarized situations, and they hope the truth commission will help to break that down. I have to say, when I was in Thailand a couple of months ago, people described how, they conveniently, rather than having political affiliations, they have colors. So the reds and the yellows, which are the two camps, have become redder and more yellow by watching TV programs and keeping it on one channel. And it's throughout the country, people became more and more sort of ingrained and radicalized into their color group by watching these incredibly, you know, sort of biased TV channel, so they had different understandings of everything as to what was happening in the country, and people are still stuck there. One of the things that the government did in the emergency decrees over the last months is to actually shut down these community-based programs, which were basically very politicized. I mean, they will come back, and they need to come back. You can't shut down the media, but that needs to, of course, change. As people described it, it reminded me of the United States. I mean, it reminded me of how people get their news here and this sort of ideological sort of flavor of so much that comes out. So I think, you know, it's not uncommon to have quite, as you say, you know, can people ever agree on facts anymore? That question is often the heart of, you know, an initiative to have a truth commission. Let's figure out a way that we can all actually agree as to what happened. There must be a way to at least get to that. And that's why it's such a hard and such an important project if you can do it right. But that's equally true here, I think, unfortunately.
Okay, we're about 15 minutes beyond the time that we wanted to end. So I'm going to cut off the discussion now and thank Priscilla Hayner. If you don't have the book, it's worth getting it. And thank you very much, David Tolbert, for taking part. And thanks to everybody else who took part in the discussion.